Part 1. The Founder's Monumental Task, Structuring a Government with All Power in the People. The Founder's Political Spectrum. Part of the genius of the Founding Fathers was their political spectrum, or political frame of reference. It was a yardstick for the measuring of the political power in any particular system of government. They had a much better political yardstick than the one which is generally used today. If the founders had used the modern yardstick of communism on the left and fascism on the right, they never would have found the balanced center which they were seeking. What is left? What is right? It is extremely unfortunate that the writers on political philosophy today have undertaken to measure various issues in terms of political parties instead of political power. No doubt the American Founding Fathers would have considered this modern measuring stick most objectionable, even meaningless. Today, as we mentioned, it is popular in the classroom as well as the press to refer to communism on the left and fascism on the right. People and parties are often called leftist or rightist. The public do not really understand what they are talking about. These terms actually refer to the manner in which the various parties are seated in the parliaments of Europe. The radical revolutionaries, usually the communists, occupy the far left, and the military dictatorships, such as the fascists, are on the far right. Other parties are located in between. Measuring people and issues in terms of political parties has turned out to be philosophically fallacious, if not totally misleading. This is because the platforms or positions of political parties are often superficial and structured on shifting sand. The platform of a political party of one generation can hardly be recognized by the next. Furthermore, communism and fascism turned out to be different names for approximately the same thing, the police state. They are not opposite extremes, but, for all practical purposes, are virtually identical. The American Founding Fathers used a more accurate yardstick. Government is defined in the dictionary as a system of ruling or controlling, and therefore the American founders measured political systems in terms of the amount of coercive power or systematic control which a particular system of government exercises over its people. In other words, the yardstick is not political parties, but political power. Using this type of yardstick, the American founders considered the two extremes to be anarchy on the one hand and tyranny on the other. At the one extreme of anarchy, there is no government, no law, no systematic control, and no governmental power, while at the other extreme, there is too much control, too much political oppression, too much government, or as the founders called it, tyranny. The object of the founders was to discover the balanced center between these two extremes. They recognized that under the chaotic confusion of anarchy, there is no law, whereas at the other extreme, the law is totally dominated by the ruling power and is therefore ruler's law. What they wanted to establish was a system of people's law, where the government is kept under the control of the people and political power is maintained at the balanced center with enough government to maintain security, justice, and good order, but not enough government to abuse the people. The founders' political spectrum might be graphically illustrated as follows. Ruler's Law. The founders seemed anxious that modern man recognize the subversive characteristics of oppressive ruler's law, which they identified primarily with the tyrannical monarchy. Here are its basic characteristics. 1. authority under ruler's law is nearly always established by force, violence, and conquest. 2. Therefore, all sovereign power is considered to be in the conqueror or his descendants. 3. The people are not equal, but are divided into classes, and are all looked upon as subjects of the king. 4. The entire country is considered to be the property of the ruler. He speaks of it as his realm. 5. The thrust of government power is from the top down, not from the people upward. 6. The people have no inalienable rights. The king giveth, and the king taketh away. 7. Government is by the whims of men, not by the fixed rule of law which the people need in order to govern the affairs with confidence. 8. The ruler issues edicts which are called the law. He then interprets the law and enforces it, thus maintaining tyrannical control over the people. 9. Under ruler's law, problems are always solved by issuing more edicts or laws, setting up more bureaus, harassing the people with more regulators, and charging the people for these services by continually adding to their burden of taxes. 10. Freedom is never looked upon as a viable solution to anything. 11. The long history of ruler's law is one of blood and terror, both anciently and in modern times. Under it, the people are stratified into an aristocracy of the ruler's retinue, while the lot of the common people is one of perpetual poverty, excessive taxation, stringent regulations, and a continuous existence of misery. The founder's attraction to people's law. In direct contrast to the harsh oppression of ruler's law, the founders, particularly Jefferson, admire the institutes of freedom under people's law as originally practiced among the Anglo-Saxons. As one authority on Jefferson points out, quote, Jefferson's great ambition at that time, 1776, was to promote a renaissance of Anglo-Saxon primitive institutions on the new continent. Thus presented, the American Revolution was nothing but the reclamation of the Anglo-Saxon birthright of which the colonists had been deprived by a long trend of abuses. Nor does it appear that there was anything in this theory which surprised or shocked his contemporaries. Adams apparently did not disapprove of it, and it would be easy to bring in many similar expressions of the same idea in documents of the time. End of quote. Characteristics of Anglo-Saxon common law, or people's law. Here are the principal points of people's law as practiced by the Anglo-Saxons. 1. They considered themselves a commonwealth of freemen. 2. All decisions and the selection of leaders had to be with the consent of the people, preferably by full consensus, not just a majority. 3. The laws by which they were governed were considered natural laws given by divine dispensation and were so well known by the people they did not have to be written down. 4. Power was dispersed among the people and never allowed to concentrate in any one person or group. Even in time of war, the authority granted to the leaders was temporary, and the power of the people to remove them was direct and simple. 5. Primary responsibility for resolving problems rested first of all with the individual, then the family, then the tribe or community, then the region, and finally the nation. 6. They were organized into small, manageable groups where every adult had a voice and a vote. They divided the people into units of 10 families who elected a leader, then 50 families who elected a leader, then 100 families who elected a leader, and then 1,000 families who elected a leader. 7. They believed the rights of the individual were considered unalienable and could not be violated without risking the wrath of divine justice as well as civil retribution by the people's judges. 8. The system of justice was structured on the basis of severe punishment unless there was complete reparation to the person who had been wronged. There were only 4 crimes or offenses against the whole people. These were treason by betraying their own people, cowardice by refusing to fight or failing to fight courageously, desertion, and homosexuality. These were considered capital offenses. All other offenses required reparation to the person who had been wronged. 9. They always attempted to solve problems on the level where the problem originated. If this was impossible, they went no higher than was absolutely necessary to get a remedy. Usually, only the most complex problems involving the welfare of the whole people or a large segment of the people ever went to the leaders for solution. The contrast between ruler's law, all power in the ruler, and people's law, all power in the people, is graphically illustrated below. Note where the power base is located under each of these systems. Also, compare the relationship between the individual and the rest of society under these two systems. The founders note the similarities between Anglo-Saxon common law and the people's law of ancient Israel. As the founders studied the record of the ancient Israelites, they were intrigued by the fact that they also operated under a system of laws remarkably similar to those of the Anglo-Saxons. The two systems were similar both in precept and operational structure. In fact, the Reverend Thomas Hooker wrote the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut based on the principles recorded by Moses in the first chapter of Deuteronomy. These fundamental orders were adopted in 1639 and constituted the first written constitution in modern times. This constitutional charter operated so successfully that it was adopted by Rhode Island. When the English colonies were converted over to independent states, these were the only two states which had constitutional documents which readily adapted themselves to the new order of self-government. All of the other states had to write new constitutions. Here are the principal characteristics of the people's law in ancient Israel, which were almost identical with those of the Anglo-Saxons. 1. They were set up as a commonwealth of freemen. A basic tenet was, proclaim liberty throughout all the land, unto all the inhabitants thereof. Leviticus 25:10. This inscription appears on the American Liberty Bell. When the Israelites fell into the temptation to have slaves or bondservants, they were reprimanded. Around 600 B.C., a divine reprimand was given through Jeremiah. Ye have not hearkened unto me in proclaiming liberty every one to his brother, and every man to his neighbor. Behold, I proclaim a liberty for you, saith the Lord. Jeremiah 34:17. 2. All the people were organized into small, manageable units, where the representative of each family had a voice and a vote. This organizing process was launched after Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, saw him trying to govern the people under ruler's law. See Exodus 18:13 through 26. When the structure was completed, the Israelites were organized as follows. Moses, Vice President Aaron, and Vice President Joshua, a Senate or Council of 70, a Congress of elected representatives, 1,000 families, 100 families, 50 families, 10 families, single family. 3. There were specific emphasis on strong local self-government. Problems were solved to the greatest possible extent on the level where they originated. The record says, "The hard causes they brought unto Moses, but every small matter they judged themselves." Exodus 18:26. 4. The entire code of justice was based primarily on reparation to the victim, rather than fines and punishment by the commonwealth. The one crime for which no satisfaction could be given was first-degree murder. The penalty was death. 5. Leaders were elected and new laws were approved by the common consent of the people. 6. Accused persons were presumed to be innocent until proven guilty. Evidence had to be strong enough to remove any question of doubt as to guilt. Borderline cases were decided in favor of the accused and he was released. It was felt that if he were actually guilty, his punishment could be left to the judgment of God in the future life. Memorializing these two examples of people's law on the U.S. seal. It was the original intent of the founders to have both the ancient Israelites and the Anglo-Saxons represented on the official seal of the United States. The members of the committee were Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin. They recommended that one side of the seal show the profiles of two Anglo-Saxons representing Hengist and Horsa. These brothers were the first Anglo-Saxons to bring their people to England around AD 450 and introduce the Institutes of People's Law into the British Isles. On the other side of the seal, this committee recommended that there be a portrayal of ancient Israel going through the wilderness, led by God's pillar of fire. In this way, the founders hoped to memorialize the two ancient peoples who had practiced people's law and from whom the founders had acquired many of their basic ideas for their new commonwealth of freedom. As it turned out, all of this was a little complicated for a small seal, and therefore a more simple design was utilized. However, here is a modern artist's rendition of the original seal as proposed by Jefferson, Adams, and Franklin. Obviously, this is a segment of America's rich heritage of the past, which has disappeared from most history books. The founders struggled to establish people's law in the balance center. In the Federalist Papers, number 9, Hamilton refers to the sensations of horror and disgust which arise when a person studies the history of those nations that are always in a state of perpetual vibration between the extremes of tyranny and anarchy. Washington also refers to the human struggle, wherein there is a natural and necessary progression from the extreme of anarchy to the extreme of tyranny. Franklin noted that there is a natural inclination in mankind to kingly government. He said it gives people the illusion that somehow a king will establish equality among citizens, and that they like. Franklin's great fear was that the states would succumb to this gravitational pull toward a strong central government, symbolized by a royal establishment. He said, "I am apprehensive, therefore, perhaps too apprehensive, that the government of these states may in future times end in a monarchy. But this catastrophe, I think, may be long delayed, if in our proposed system we do not sow the seeds of contention, faction, and tumult by making our posts of honor places of profit." The founders' task was to somehow solve the enigma of the human tendency to rush headlong from anarchy to tyranny, the very thing which later happened in the French Revolution. How could the American people be constitutionally structured so that they would take a fixed position at the balance center of the political spectrum and forever maintain a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, which would not perish from the earth. It took the Founding Fathers 180 years, 1607 to 1787, to come up with their American formula. In fact, just 11 years before the famous Constitutional Convention at Philadelphia, the Founders wrote a constitution which almost caused them to lose the Revolutionary War. Their first attempt at constitutional writing was called the Articles of Confederation. The Founders' first constitution ends up too close to anarchy. The American Revolutionary War did not commence as a war for independence, but was originally designed merely to protect the rights of the people from the arrogant oppression of a tyrannical king. Nevertheless, by the spring of 1776, it was becoming apparent that a complete separation was the only solution. It is interesting that even before the Declaration of Independence, the Continental Congress appointed a committee on June 11, 1776, to write a constitution. John Dickinson served as chairman of the committee and wrote a draft based on a proposal made by Benjamin Franklin in 1775. However, the states felt that Dickinson's so-called Articles of Confederation gave too much power to the central government. They therefore hacked away at the draft until November 15, 1777, when they proclaimed that the new central government would have no powers whatsoever except those expressly authorized by the states. And the states did not expressly authorize much of anything. Under the Articles of Confederation as finally adopted, there was no executive, no judiciary, no taxing power, and no enforcement power. The national government ended up being little more than a general committee of the states. It made recommendations to the states and then prayed they would respond favorably. Very often they did not. On the founders' political spectrum, the Articles of Confederation would appear as follows. The suffering and death at Valley Forge and Morristown were an unforgettable demonstration of the abject weakness of the central government and its inability to provide food, clothes, equipment, and manpower for the war. At Valley Forge, the common fare for 6 weeks was flour, water, and salt mixed together and baked in a skillet. Fire cakes, they were called. Out of approximately 8,000 soldiers, around 3,000 abandoned General Washington and went home. Approximately 200 officers resigned their commissions. Over 2,000 soldiers died of starvation and disease. Washington attributed this near disaster at Valley Forge to the constitutional weakness of the central government under the Articles of Confederation. The genius of the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Not one of the Founding Fathers could have come up with a much-needed constitutional formula by himself, and the delegates who attended the convention knew it. At that very moment, the states were bitterly divided. The continental dollar was inflated almost out of existence. The economy was deeply depressed, and rioting had broken out. New England had threatened to secede, and both England and Spain were standing close by, ready to snatch up the disunited states at the first propitious opportunity. Writing a constitution under these circumstances was a frightening experience. None of the delegates had expected the convention to require 4 tedious months. In fact, within a few weeks, many of the delegates, including James Madison, were living on borrowed funds. From the opening day of the convention, it was known that the brainstorming discussions would require frequent shifting of positions and changing of minds. For this reason, the convention debates were held in secret to avoid public embarrassment as the delegates made concessions, reversed earlier positions, and moved gradually towards some kind of agreement. A special device employed to encourage open discussion. To encourage the delegates to freely express themselves without the usual formalities of a convention, the majority of the discussions were conducted in what they called the Committee of the Whole. This committee consisted of all the members of the convention, but as a committee, decisions were always tentative and never binding in the same way they would have been if voted upon by the convention. Only after a thorough ventilating of the issues would the Committee of the Whole turn themselves back into a sitting of the convention and formally approve what they had just discussed in the committee. The object of the founders was to seek a consensus or general agreement on what the Constitution should provide. After 4 months of debate, they were able to reach general agreement on just about everything except the issues of slavery, proportionate representation, and the regulation of commerce. All three of these issues had to be settled by compromise. It is a mistake, however, to describe the rest of the Constitution as a conglomerate of compromises, because extreme patience was used to bring the minds of the delegates into agreement rather than simply force the issue to finality with a compromise. This is demonstrated in the fact that over 60 ballots were taken before they resolved the issue of how to elect the president. They could have let the matter lie after the first ballot, but they did not. They were anxious to talk it out until the vast majority felt good about the arrangement. That is why it took 60 ballots to resolve the matter. When the founders had finished their work on September 17, 1787, President Washington attached a letter to the signed draft and sent it to the Congress. The Congress ratified the Constitution without any changes and sent it to the states. When several of the larger states threatened to reject the Constitution, they were invited to ratify the main body of the Constitution, but attach suggested amendments. They submitted 189. At the first session of Congress, these suggested amendments were reduced to 12 by James Madison, and 10 of them were finally approved and ratified by the states. Thus was born America's famous Bill of Rights. The Balance Center. This was the polemic process by which the founders struggled to get the American eagle firmly planted in the balance center of the political spectrum. James Madison later described the division of labor between the states and the federal government as follows. Quote, "The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. The powers reserved to the several states will extend to all the objects which, in the ordinary course of affairs, concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people, and the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state." The fixing of the American eagle in the center of the spectrum was designed to maintain this political equilibrium between the people in the states and the federal government. The idea was to keep the power base close to the people. The emphasis was on strong local self-government. The states would be responsible for internal affairs, and the federal government would confine itself to those areas which could not be fairly or effectively handled by the individual states. This made the founders' political spectrum look approximately like this. America's Three-Headed Eagle. Although Polybius, John Locke, and Baron Charles de Montesquieu had all advocated the separation of governmental functions into three departments, legislative, executive, and judicial, The American founders were the first to carefully structure what might be described as a three-headed eagle. The central head was the lawmaking or legislative function with two eyes, the House and the Senate, and these must both see eye to eye on any piece of legislation before it can become law. A second head is the administrative or executive department with all authority centered in a single strong president operating within a clearly defined framework of limited power. The third head is the judiciary, which was assigned the task of acting as guardian of the Constitution and the interpretation of its principles as originally designed by the founders. The genius of this three-headed eagle was not only the separation of powers, but the fact that all three heads operated through a single neck. By this means, the founders carefully integrated these three departments so that each one was coordinated with the others and could not perform independently of them. It was an ingeniously structured pattern of political power, which might be described as coordination without consolidation. The two wings of the eagle. The founders' view of their new form of government can be further demonstrated by using the symbol of the eagle and referring to its wings. Wing number one of the eagle might be referred to as the problem-solving wing or the wing of compassion. Those who function through this dimension of the system are sensitive to the unfulfilled needs of the people. They dream of elaborate plans to solve these problems. Wing number two has the responsibility of conserving the nation's resources and the people's freedom. It functions to analyze the programs of wing number one with two questions. First, can we afford it? Secondly, what will it do to the rights and individual freedom of the people? Now, if both of these wings fulfill their assigned function, the American eagle will fly straighter and higher than any civilization in the history of the world. But if either of these wings goes to sleep on the job, the American eagle will drift toward anarchy or tyranny. For example, if wing number one becomes infatuated with the idea of solving all the problems of the nation regardless of the cost, and wing number two fails to bring its power into play to sober the problem solvers with a more realistic approach, the eagle will spin off toward the left, which is tyranny. On the other hand, if wing number one fails to see the problems which need solving, and wing number two becomes inflexible in its course of not solving problems simply to save money or not disturb the status quo, then the machinery of government loses its credibility and the eagle drifts over toward the right, where the people decide to take matters into their own hands. This can eventually disintegrate into anarchy. Thomas Jefferson describes the need for balance. When Thomas Jefferson became president, he used his first inaugural address to describe the need to make room for the problem-solving wing, to which his own Democratic Republican Party belonged, and also make room for the conservation wing, to which the Federalist Party of John Adams belonged. He tried to stress the fact that all Americans should have some elements of both of these party dimensions in their thinking. In his inaugural address, he said, quote, "We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." End of quote. The problem of political extremists. Nevertheless, Jefferson saw fringe elements in both of these parties, which were political extremists. In the Federalist Party were those who would pull the eagle away from its balanced center toward the tyrannical left and form a central government so strong that it would border on a monarchy. concerning the monarchist fringe of the Federalist Party, he wrote, quote, "I have spoken of the Federalists as if they were a homogeneous body, but this is not the truth. Under that name lurks the heretical sect of monarchists. Afraid to wear their own name, they creep under the mantle of federalism, and the federalists, like sheep, permit the fox to take shelter among them when pursued by dogs. These men have no right to office. If a monarchist be in office anywhere, and it be known to the president, the oath he has taken to support the Constitution imperiously requires the instantaneous dismission of such officer, and I hold the president criminal if he permitted such to remain. To appoint a monarchist to conduct the affairs of a republic is like appointing an atheist to the priesthood. As to the real Federalists, I take them to my bosom as brothers. I view them as honest men, friends to the present Constitution." End of quote. Jefferson's conversation with Washington. Jefferson reports a conversation with President Washington in August 1793, in which Jefferson expressed deep concern that some elements of the president's administration were pushing toward oppressive monarchical-type powers. The president immediately responded that republican principles must be maintained and that the Constitution we have is an excellent one if we can keep it where it is. With reference to the possibility of a monarchical party arising, President Washington stated that there was not a man in the United States who would set his face more decidedly against it than himself. Jefferson, nevertheless, pointed out to the president that, quote, "There does not pass a week in which we cannot prove declarations dropping from the monarchical party, the branch of the administration pushing for a central government with massive powers, and saying that our government is good for nothing, is a milk and water thing which cannot support itself. We must knock it down and set up something of more energy." End of quote. President Washington replied that if anyone were guilty of such nonsense, it would be a proof of their insanity. Jefferson's concern about the radical fringe element in his own party. In May 1805, while serving as president, Jefferson wrote to Dr. George Logan. He was concerned with elements of extremism pushing toward the extreme right, which to the founders meant anarchy. He wrote, quote, "I see with infinite pain the bloody schism which has taken place among our friends in Pennsylvania and New York, and will probably take place in other states. The main body of both sections mean well, but their good intentions will produce great public evil." End of quote. Like President Washington, Jefferson saw the need for maintaining the government in the balanced center where the Constitution had placed it. He wrote to Governor George Clinton in 1803, "Our business is to march straight forward without either turning to the right or left. With both of the eagle's wings flying, one solving problems, the other preserving resources and freedom, the American future could not help but ascend to unprecedented heights of wealth and influence." The founders warned against a drift toward the collectivist left. Since the genius of the American system is maintaining the eagle in the balanced center of the spectrum, the founders warned against a number of temptations which might lure subsequent generations to abandon their freedoms and their rights by subjecting themselves to a strong federal administration operating on the collectivist left. They warned against the welfare state, where the government endeavors to take care of everyone from the cradle to the grave. Jefferson wrote, quote, if we can prevent the government from wasting the labors of the people under the pretense of taking care of them, they must become happy. End of quote. They warned against confiscatory taxation and deficit spending. Jefferson said it was immoral for one generation to pass on the results of its extravagance in the form of debts to the next generation. He wrote, "We shall all consider ourselves unauthorized to saddle posterity with our debts, and morally bound to pay them ourselves, and consequently within what may be deemed the period of a generation, or the life expectancy of the majority." Every generation of Americans struggled to pay off the national debt up until the present one. The founders also warned that the only way for the nation to prosper was to have equal protection of rights and not allow the government to get involved in trying to provide equal distribution of things. They also warned against the pooling of property as advocated by the proponents of communism. Samuel Adams said they had done everything possible to make the ideas of socialism and communism unconstitutional. Said he, quote, "The utopian schemes of leveling, redistribution of the wealth, and a community of goods, central ownership of the means of production and distribution, are as visionary and impractical as those which vest all property in the crown. These ideas are arbitrary, despotic, and in our government, unconstitutional." End of quote. The need for an enlightened electorate. To prevent the American eagle from tipping toward anarchy on the right or tyranny on the left, and to see that the American system remained in a firm, fixed position in the balanced center of the political spectrum, the founders campaigned for a strong program of widespread education. Channels were needed through which the founders and other leaders could develop and maintain an intelligent, informed electorate. Jefferson hammered home the necessity for an educated electorate on numerous occasions. Here are some examples. Quote, "If the nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. No other sure foundation can be devised for the preservation of freedom and happiness. Preach a crusade against ignorance. Establish and improve the law for educating the common people. Let our countrymen know that the people alone can protect us against these evils of misgovernment." End of quotes. What the founders really wanted was a system of educational communication through which they could transfer their great body of fundamental beliefs based on self-evident truths. They knew they had made a great discovery, and they wanted their posterity to maintain it. As Madison said, "It is something which it is incumbent on their successors to improve and perpetuate." The founders' common denominator of basic beliefs. One of the most amazing aspects of the American story is that while the nation's founders came from widely divergent backgrounds, their fundamental beliefs were virtually identical. They quarreled bitterly over the most practical plan of implementing those beliefs, but rarely, if ever, disputed about their final objectives or basic convictions. These men came from several different churches, and some from no churches at all. They ranged in occupation from farmers to presidents of universities. Their social background included everything from wilderness pioneering to the aristocracy of landed estates. Their dialects included everything from the loquacious drawl of South Carolina to the clipped staccato of Yankee New England. Their economic origins included everything from frontier poverty to opulent wealth. Then how do we explain their remarkable unanimity in fundamental beliefs? Perhaps the explanation will be found in the fact that they were all remarkably well read, and mostly from the same books. Although the level of their formal training varied from spasmodic doses of home tutoring to the rigorous regimen of Harvard's classical studies, the debates in the Constitutional Convention and the writings of the founders reflect a far broader knowledge of religious, political, historical, economic, and philosophical studies than would be found in any cross-section of American leaders today. The thinking of Polybius, Cicero, Thomas Hooker, Cook, Montesquieu, Blackstone, John Locke, and Adam Smith salt and peppered their writings and their conversations. They were also careful students of the Bible, especially the Old Testament. And even though some did not belong to any Christian denomination, the teachings of Jesus were held in universal respect and admiration. Their historical readings included a broad perspective of Greek, Roman, Anglo-Saxon, European, and English history. To this writer, nothing is more remarkable about the early American leaders than their breadth of reading and depth of knowledge concerning the essential elements of sound nation building. Fundamental principles. The relative uniformity of fundamental thought shared by these men included strong and unusually well-defined convictions concerning religious principles, political precepts, economic fundamentals, and long-range social goals. On particulars, of course, they quarreled, but when discussing fundamental precepts and ultimate objectives, they seemed practically unanimous. They even had strong criticism for one another as individual personalities, yet admired each other as laborers in the common cause. John Adams, for example, felt a strong personality conflict between himself and Benjamin Franklin and even Thomas Jefferson. Yet Adams' writings are steeped in accolades for both of them, and their writings carried the same for him. One of George Washington's most vehement critics was Dr. Benjamin Rush, and yet that Pennsylvania physician boldly supported everything for which Washington worked and fought. We will now proceed to carefully examine the 28 major principles on which the American founders established the first free people in modern times. These are great ideas which provided the intellectual, political, and economic climate for the 5,000-year leap.